Oh, that's right. We are here this afternoon, and I have a real treat outside. The fact is that right now around Sharp Facets Gallery, I don't believe it's raining. I understand it is raining all around, and I tell you what, the rain has been coming down in huge drops today. I don't think I've ever seen them as big as I have today. But today we have Robert Glick with us. He is a semi-retired professor of worship, church music, and organ at Erskine College, and he was also served as the organist and teaching pastor at First Pres Church right here in Greenwood, and he continues to do a lot of great things. Right now, he is the choral director of the Festival Chorale, so you probably have seen him, you've probably heard him, and we're going to talk to him today about all the things that he's done, plus he has written a book, so there you go. We're going to be talking about it right here on WCRS. Welcome to the show, Robert Glick. How are you today?
I am very well. Thanks for having me here today.
Absolutely. Well, I know that the Festival Chorale is, you took that over from Dr. Gaines. So
sure did, yeah.
Those were big shoes to fill.
Indeed, they are. And he did a magnificent job with that group since, I forget exactly when, about 1990, I believe, is when he got that group started again. He was not the first one to do a chorale for Greenwood. They go back quite a few years. Paul Cresswell at Lander University had it for a while, and before him, Marion Smith, who also taught at Lander for a while, started. I think he did the first one. So what Dr. Gaines did was to restart the chorale, which had languished for quite a number of years and achieved wonders with the group. So I'm honored to be able to try to fill those shoes as best I can.
Well, I'm sure you're doing a great job. I've heard good things about it. But how many members are there in the Festival Chorale?
Well, it varies depending on circumstances and what kind of music we're doing at the concert. It's really not always exactly the same group. If we do a religious program, that draws a certain group of singers. And if we do a patriotic program or a Broadway show tunes program, the crowd changes a little bit. There's that core group that's always there. We've been averaging about 65.
That's a big group.
Year. Well,
that's a big group.
You can do a lot with a group like that.
I guess you can. You know, one of the things that I find so amazing about the Festival Chorale is you don't have to try out for this. You take all.
Well, that's right. You know, everything has its plus side and its negative side, and while that limits the difficulty of some of the music that we can do, in a small town like Greenwood, where we're after not just singing the best music we can, but providing a service, frankly, to the community, we don't want to be closing out people who would enjoy that kind of an opportunity. And these days, there's so much choral music out there that there's plenty of wonderful things to sing that may not be quite so complicated. And this group rises to a challenge pretty well. They're used to doing some rather complicated things under Dr. Gaines, and I've been pushing them with some of the pieces as well. So, you know, it's amazing what you get a group of people together to do, and folks can learn to do things that they couldn't do all by themselves. That's one of the beauties of a choir.
That's right. That's where you just move your mouth, right?
Well, you actually have so much support going on around you that while you're doing that at first, eventually you find yourself actually learning those hard parts.
You find your voice? Yes,
yes,
there you go.
You do.
Well, one of the things we did want to mention is that the next Christmas concert will be coming up on December 10th. And it's called Follow the Star, and you're actually going to begin practice, aren't you, on September 10th?
That's exactly right. Just a few weeks.
That's hard to believe that September's almost here, isn't it?
Yes, every year you wonder what happened to the summertime.
Exactly. But it's going to be September 10th from 7 to 9 in the sanctuary at First Pres Church right here in Greenwood. So if you'd like to be part of it, all you got to do is come out, right?
All you have to do is show up. There is a membership fee that we use to help to defray the costs. It's not much. I hesitate to say because I don't remember exactly what it is, but it's certainly affordable. And if it's not affordable, we don't insist upon it. But we do want anybody who thinks they would enjoy an experience like this. It helps if you have had experience singing in a choir before, but it's worth giving it a try if you think you would enjoy that.
Absolutely.
Love to have them.
So Follow the Star is going to be the theme, and of course always a Christmas concert is really, really good. You do one in June with the Festival of Flowers, right?
That's correct.
And then you do one more, or is that it?
Two, well, sometimes or three? We've done both. Sometimes it's just been two, but we have worked very closely with First Presbyterian Church's Festiva music series, and they've invited us on many occasions to do a concert that happens in between those two. We may do that again this year. We're not sure about that yet, but we'll be discussing that with the choir at our very first meeting and see how the choir feels about adding that third event. We did not do one last year. And that event usually is one that gives us the chance to work with a very large pipe organ, which you don't always get a chance to do.
Yes.
And so that opens up the door for all sorts of choir music and literature that would not work as well with a piano.
Sure. So these are the things that are happening with the Festival of Chorale. But Robert Glick, you have had just a fascinating life here. Grew up in Reading, Pennsylvania. Is that right?
Well, Lebanon.
Lebanon.
I'd worked in Reading.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, I'm a native of Lebanon.
And how'd you end up down here in South Carolina?
Well, you go where there's a job often, and
yes.
In the music area in general, and certainly in church music, one can't afford to be too picky about where one is going to go. I was in Dallas, Texas, actually, working on my master's degree in church in sacred music, MSM, and applying for jobs here, there, and wherever I saw one that looked good. And when the smoke cleared, I had ended up at First Presbyterian Church in Greenville, South Carolina, and spent a number of years there as a full-time minister of music, organist, and choir director. And then that got me into South Carolina, and I've been in this area ever since.
So you have taught at Erskine.
Yes.
Yes. And you've done quite a bit with organ music. In fact, you were part of NPR's Pipe Dreams program, and that was, they picked the part where the dedication for First Pres Church?
That's right. Yeah, my main musical interest has always been choir music and the organ. I majored in organ at college. My training was in music education, but my major instrument was the organ, and that was true in graduate school as well. So it made sense that I did not start at Erskine as the organ professor, but when the previous organ professor, Mrs. Cortland Kuntz, retired, they simply asked me to take over where she had left off, and so that was great. And so I just completed my 25th year at Erskine, so I think I started teaching organ my second year there, so it's been 24 years that I've been doing that.
Wow, that's pretty amazing.
It's been a long time.
Absolutely. You know, you don't think of the organ, you know, for so many different parts. It really is basically for church music, yes?
It is basically. That's I think that's well said, Anne. It's basically for church music. The church, for many centuries, as you know, has adopted the organ. It's the obvious choice if you want to lead a large number of people in singing. The organ works very well for that, and it would take quite an orchestra to do that in a lot of churches. So the organ naturally won. Of course, these days there's lots of other options, you know,
with keyboards and
keyboards and praise bands and so forth. But there's still a lot of organ playing going on, and a lot of pipe organ companies still building pipe organs in the United States. It's
for
by
real.
No means a dead thing. So we don't get as many organ students as we used to, but there's still people studying organ. And quite a batch, frankly, of young, really fine organists, concert organists who are playing in symphony halls. There's a lot of pipe organ building recently in major symphony halls throughout the United States.
Wow.
There's still a lot going on.
That's very cool. You know, one of the things that I think is that patriotic music and church music really are the ones that can tug at your heart.
How true that is. And, they hit close at what we love. We feel our attachments to our nation. And for those of us of religious faith, that's obviously true, the way we feel about our God as well. So I don't know many other things except perhaps family that can tug more closely at what is really important to us.
Absolutely. You are right. Well, I am here with Robert Glick. He is a semi-retired professor of worship and church music at Erskine College. He is the choral director over there right now of Festival Chorale, and he's got some other fascinating things to tell us. So don't you go away. We'll be right back.
Gold. Gold. More precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood. Telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too. Paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
Oh, that's right. We're right back here, Sharp Facets Gallery on the 72 bypass. I tell you what, we did see the sun just a little bit this afternoon. It just piqued our interest just to have the rain come pouring back down again. But we are here at Sharp Facets. We are talking with Robert Glick, and of course, he is the organist and teaching pastor at First Pres Church pretty much on a full-time basis. And you told me you were going to start teaching some classes this fall, and you don't have to take a test, and you don't get any college credit either. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, we've already done this for a year already. It's called the First Presbyterian Academy, and we're trying to offer religious education at a slightly more intense level than you would get in your typical Sunday school class, something like what you might get in a college class, but as you say, without the tests and, and responsibilities, and we are not offering any credit for these things. But last year, we had three or four options that included not only some of us from the clergy at First Presbyterian Church, but we had the pastor from the Episcopal Church in town, and also the pastor from First Baptist Church. So it really is becoming a community event, and we're getting 50, 60 people at these courses. I'll be teaching on Genesis starting the second Monday in September and going for 2 months.
Wow. Second Monday in September, so that is coming up. That'll be the 9th of September.
Yeah.
That's right.
Open to anybody.
So anybody
no
can come.
No requirements except to be there.
Is there a cost?
There is I think $15 that we ask for as a donation, but that should not be an issue for anybody.
Okay.
It certainly isn't required.
Okay, and there's no tests.
No tests.
Okay,
no.
So for those of you
no
that
textbooks
have...
textbooks other no. than the Bible.
So. Okay, that's pretty easy then.
That's right.
That's right. So there are classes that are going on that you're teaching. Now, you know, one of the things I always like to talk about is what you wanted to be when you were growing up. I always find that fascinating to find out where somebody started and where they ended up.
Well, when I was very, very young, like all kids, you know, you want to be a policeman, you want to be a doctor, you want to be this, that, and the other thing. But as my musical interests kicked in rather early, I started piano lessons when I was 9 years old. Seven years old.
Okay. Was that your desire, or did your mom or dad say you're going to take?
That's what we did in the Glick household.
Right.
When you were seven, you started piano lessons.
Yeah. No conversation.
Two older sisters did the same, and so I fell in line there. But soon learned to love music. And when I was in junior high school, I noticed that the our choral teacher, who was also our regular general music teacher, not only was doing the sorts of things that I was very interested in, but I noticed that a lot of students would come to her with problems or for counseling, you might say. And then when I got into high school, I noticed the same thing, that a lot of students just gravitated to the music teacher. And there's that in me that found that interesting. I guess that's why I eventually got ordained as a pastor somewhere along the line. So I just knew I was going to be a public school music teacher, and I trained for that in college, got my degree in music education with a major in organ. And took my first job in Ellicott City, Maryland, just outside Baltimore, as a public school general music teacher.
How'd that go?
It did not go well.
It did not go well. Okay.
I found that what I was looking for musically had been much more developed. You know, after going to college as a music major and singing with fine choirs and making music at a high level, it's a little bracing to go into a middle school where there isn't that much music making going on the way I had come to know music making, sure, the way I love to make music. And I learned that about myself, that that was very important. Plus, junior high school kids being who they are, bless their hearts, they are not inclined to be looking much interested in anything that has to do with school at that point. And I really struggled with that emotionally. It was very, very draining, and it was a long year for me. I liked the kids, and they told me that they liked me, but I could not handle that disconnect, their lack of interest.
Their rejection.
Rejection,
really, yeah.
You might as well say it, and that's what it was, and that hurts. And I found out that I couldn't handle that. So I was very blessed that I was made aware of a church very near my home in Pennsylvania, a Lutheran church that was looking for their first full-time minister of music. They did not want somebody with a master's degree.
That was good for you.
That was perfect for me, very providential. And so when the smoke cleared, I was hired for that position. And I learned that that put the priorities of my life, which hadn't changed, but in a much better order. I could make music at a much higher level at the organ. I got to work with adult choirs. I still got to work with children and youth, which I have always loved doing. I've always been drawn to children and youth, and so that fit a lot better.
So there you go. There's the story of how you went from public education to into church music.
That's right. And now back into education again.
Yeah, that's you were telling me off the air that if you know something, you just want to share it with everybody.
Yeah,
it's a passion.
I'm nothing so much as a teacher. I don't know what it is, but that's how it is. I find that I read a new book and I learn something, and I want to talk to somebody about it. I want to share with them. I'm excited about what I've learned, and I guess that's what drives a teacher to teach the same things year after year.
Absolutely.
I never get tired of starting new organ students or teaching the same course over again. It's the excitement of sharing that with somebody who doesn't know it.
What do you think about music, though? In a lot of aspects in the schools and whatnot, music has been kind of pushed aside.
In many cases, it has been. Well, we all know the difficulties there are in fundings in schools these days and how tight things are. So, unfortunately, it's often the arts that take it in the chin in situations like that. Music, certainly, but, art, metal shop or wood shop class, home economics, things like that, the more creative courses often are the ones that get axed because you can't drop the math and you can't drop the English.
Sure.
Sorts of things. So that's been a problem.
What do you think music does for young people?
Well, that's the sad part about it. Music, I think, is an essential thing. The pastor in me has thought a lot about why God created music and why it's so powerful. You know, it's interesting. When I was at public school, that one year that I taught in the middle school, I noticed how strong the children's reactions were. If I played music by one rock group, half the kids would love it. The other half would get very physically agitated and start shouting. And they didn't get that upset about fashions or other artistic things, but there's something about music that really gets down deep with people very, very quickly. People's reactions to music is very, very strong. I think God created it that way, which gives a responsibility to those of us who are teaching music. And it also shows that that's an important part of who we are as human beings. People just can't live without music. There's not a culture anywhere in the world, I learned, where music is not a big part of the culture. Human beings can't live without it, apparently.
Wow. Very interesting stuff here. When we come back, we're going to be talking about a book that he wrote. It's all about the right brain, left brain. It's not too deep. I'll make sure it doesn't get too deep. I guess it could be deep, but we're not going to make it deep. But it's interesting stuff, and part of the reason that I asked him to come on was to talk about his book, With All Thy Mind, that we're going to be talking about. Interesting stuff about music, though. Do want to talk a little bit more about the effect of music and what it does or doesn't do for us, and how some of the types of music have evolved would be my next question. Mm-hmm. But don't you go away, because we're going to be right back right here on WCRS. South Carolina News is up, and we'll be back. Don't you go away.
McDonald's presents Confessions of an Ex-Hipster.
I loved cappuccinos, so I put on an itchy turtleneck and grew a goatee. But before I knew it, I was into French films, indie rock, and not bathing. Luckily, I got help from McDonald's McCafé Cappuccinos. Now I'm watching football, wearing khakis, even high-fiving again. Thank you, McDonald's.
New McCafé mochas, lattes, and cappuccinos from McDonald's. With fresh ground espresso and real steamed milk, it's all the coffee, hold the attitude. At participating McDonald's.
Visit your local McDonald's in Greenwood and Abbeville today.
Oh, that's right. We're right back here. Sharp Facets Gallery. Yes, I'm Ann Eller. I am here with Robert Glick, and we've been having some fascinating conversation here. I think we ought to talk a little bit about it, Robert. You know, one of the things that you and I were just talking about is the different types of worship that is going on. Your traditional worship is not necessarily the center, and so many churches are changing. Why do you think this is happening?
Well, it all started in about 1960 for reasons I won't bother going into right now. So it's been going on for half a century now. So there's, in one sense, there's nothing new about what's going on.
Almost, it's definitely become more casual.
Well, it has, but so has our culture in general. I mean, look at the way we dress now. Look at the way we talk to each other as compared to, I was about to say I'm a Civil War maniac, which is true, but I have a great interest in the Civil War. And when you read the kind of letters that men would write to their wives back home there, it is very stilted and formal. I mean, that's a huge difference in time, but
how you doing?
Well, it is. It is.
Yeah.
It is. And so the differences in culture keep moving faster, I think, because electronic media keep developing and make those sorts of things an option. And of course, it's people who go to church, and people are part of a culture, and they're influenced by all of that. And so there's been constant questioning in churches for, to what degree do we try to match the culture, and to what degree do we kind of stand outside the culture and be a part of it and yet address the issues from the outside? Because after all, religion is about a God who is outside the culture. And there's good arguments on both sides of that, and the church has often been guilty of either being too involved in the culture, getting sucked into it, and frankly not being much different from the culture, and in other times being so separate from it that it's of no use to influence the culture. In terms of the kind of worship that are going on these days, they are radically different from one place to another. And we're radically different. It's kind of nice, I think, in many ways, to have those options. As an ordained minister, I don't see a whole lot of worship styles that I'm dead set against or even opposed to. I certainly have some that I don't enjoy being a part of, and others that I do. But I think there's a lot of ways to do worship. And of course, musically speaking, there's a lot of options out there as the different styles continue to fuse. You know, it's not just rock and pop and classical and country anymore, but each have influenced each other so much. From other countries, other continents. Look how African music has fused with so many different styles. Reggae, and you know,
absolutely,
you can go on and on and on with these fusions, so that the musical options are just manifold.
They certainly are. You know, one of the things, the Pope, our new Pope, mm-hmm, who is so different, so down to earth. I understand that he even called back to Brazil to have his newspaper subscription canceled. I mean, and his ideas and everything, definitely, what shall we call them, old-fashioned, down-to-earth values. It'll mm-hmm. be interesting to see over time how he evolves, or does he remain the Pope of the people?
Well, that's exactly right. I am not Roman Catholic, but I do follow papal matters to some degree. It's very interesting, and of course, I wish them well. The last number of popes have certainly been, at least three, I'd say, have been of a very different sort from any that we've had in how many centuries, I can't even say. There it is again. The Catholic Church is a part of a world culture and cannot help but respond to that in some ways.
Sure. So, you know, we've been talking a little bit about the music and how it affects and where the culture and everything. Do you have any idea where you think it's all going to go?
I do have. It's been my job as a seminary professor of worship and church music to have my finger on the pulse of all this, and I have. And I've been involved in church music ever since I was a child, and all these radical changes started about 1960. I was 9 years old then, and certainly aware of what was going on, some of the newer things that were beginning shortly after that. Those of us who really study this, I think, are seeing that what's going to go on is a continued amount of variety. What's intriguing, all my life I've been hearing you had better change or die
right. When
it comes to church music and worship styles. And what's clear after over 50 years now is that the traditional way of doing worship is not dying. There are still plenty of churches that where things look pretty much the same as they did in 1950. And a lot of churches where there's a blend of all sorts of different styles, and of course some that have really try to stay as cutting edge as they can. I don't see that changing. As the culture keeps moving faster and offering more and more options, it's ridiculous to try to stay on whatever the most current cutting edge is, because it's going to change in 4 or 5 years. Nothing stays the same long anymore. So I think there increasingly will be, for whatever you want, if you're interested in a worship experience, there's going to, even in Greenwood, there's a church for about whatever you want right here in town. And, you know, it's just a small town.
It is. So what do you think? You know, I keep looking at language and how it is changing, like people writing emails and the abbreviations mm-hmm. and everything mm-hmm. that you see. I mean, you really have to be on top of things to be able to read, particularly some of the young people's writings. So, I would wonder how the Bible is going to survive intact the way it is, or will the language actually change in the Bible? What do you think?
Well, the language has changed in the Bible. You know, there are new translations coming out, even just in English. Oh, my goodness, I hate to guess. certainly every 10 years, there's a new translation of the Bible coming out. You know, for so many centuries, it was the King James Version from right. the 1600s, and that was it. But now there's the American Standard Version and the New American Standard Version
and
a Revised Standard Version and the New International Bible and the English Standard Version. Bibles being translated specifically for children and for adults who have lower reading levels. Translations that are designed to be as close to the original Greek as possible. So they're good for theologians to study. The wording is rather wooden, but if you want to know what the actual meaning of a Greek or Hebrew term is, they're good for that, but not so good for reading for devotional purposes. So really, I'd say the Christian church is doing a very good job of keeping up with language changes. Now, in terms of a Bible that that does what a text message does, I don't know that there's any interest in that. You kind of lose.
Will there be the text message Bible? Yes. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, it'll be a little hard to be authoritative when you're that loosey-goosey with the language.
That's true. Hey, I tell you what, we're going to hear a quick word from our sponsors, and we're going to be back here with Robert Glick. If you've got a telephone question, give us a call, 229-7984. That's 229-7984. We'll be right back.
Gold dust at my feet on the sunny side of...
This year will be a simpler year. One fine gift to last a lifetime, from Mother Earth with love. A diamond to light the way and create the energy to keep your love alive. Only at Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood, 229-6276.
Oh, that's right. We're right back here, Sharp Facets Gallery. How you doing this afternoon? Having a fascinating conversation this afternoon with Robert Glick. And, of course, he is the director of the Festival Chorale, the new for over a year now. And he also serves as organist and teaching pastor at First Presbyterian Church right here in Greenwood. And he's semi-retired professor of worship at Church Music and Organ at Erskine. So, you know, we were just talking about the English language.
Such
as it is. And, you know, I really worry that someday we're not going to have, you know, the words are changing so fast that, do you ever feel that as a human being, you could become outdated in your own time?
Oh, I feel like C.S. Lewis, who's one of my heroes, said that he had become a dinosaur. that he lived in his own mind in a world that no longer existed. And I think a lot of us who are of a certain age increasingly feel that way. You know, what have adults always said about the younger generation?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think it was interesting you were telling me about what you tell your students in school.
Well, it's this issue of the culture changing faster and faster and faster. You know, I definitely am aware that I am just not cool anymore.
Are you okay with that?
No.
No, you're not.
I work with kids. And I try desperately to keep up.
But you, it's pretty bad when you're trying to keep up with kids, isn't it?
Yeah, you just can't fight it after a while.
Yeah.
But what I told them, you know, I've become antiquated quicker than my parents have. And they, as it's not going to take them long at all until they're going to feel very old indeed. Because nothing stays cool, nothing stays current for long.
Well, the other thing,
and
the internet.
It's hard keeping up. You know, once you get out of school and you get a real life and you have a job and you're raising kids and all that, you don't have time to stay up on a lot of that stuff.
That's true. And I do think the internet changed everything. You know, I just wonder.
Oh, my word, yes.
I just wonder if we had the option to flip the switch on the internet, Al Gore, if he would have flipped the switch if he'd known what the result was going to be. I mean, there's been so many good things, but then, you know, when you look at life and everything, there's been a lot of changes. Well, I'm not sure they were all that good.
You know, and one of the things I've noticed in life is that for every good thing, there's kind of a dark side to it.
We got the dark side on the internet.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I am so grateful for the internet. It is amazing to me to be riding around in my car and pull out the phone. I'll be talking with a friend about who knows what, about who the last emperor of China was.
Yes.
And all you have to do is pick up your telephone, mind you, and you can get the and speak into the phone and say, the last emperor of China. And in 15 seconds, you have the answer to that. My goodness, I used to have to wait till I got to an encyclopedia to do that sort of thing.
What's an encyclopedia?
Exactly. Exactly. So what a magnificent help. The internet is. I am incredibly excited about the internet. But like every good thing, it's got its dark side.
Yeah.
And there are great dangers with the internet. I just was reading recently about how easy it is to get into pornography on the internet and what that means for our children. Yes. That's just one little area. Or finding out how to make a nuclear bomb, for that matter.
Absolutely. It is amazing what is out there. But we do want to spend a little time talking about your book. Now, you've written a fascinating book, and we don't have a whole lot of time, but we should talk about it. Tell us a little bit about your book. The name of the book is?
Name of the book is With All Thy Mind, and then the subtitle is Worship That Honors the Way God Made Us.
And how did you get into this topic now?
Yeah.
This is an interesting story, I do believe.
Well, it's a whole lifetime involved in this. Of course, I've been involved in the church all my life as a musician and as a Sunday school teacher, and then later as an ordained pastor. So I have one foot in the clergy side of the church and another foot in strongly embedded in the musical life of the church. And I've been interested, as I've lived various places in the United States, that the music department's often called the war department of the church.
Why is that?
Well, because there's musicians tend to be emotional people. You run into prima donnas in the choir. But also it's because the difference between right and left brain. Pastors often tend to be left-brained, more dominant, wordy people, and musicians.
For real. I never would have guessed that about a pastor. There
yeah,
you go.
I knew that would come to you as a great shock.
Yeah.
And musicians are involved in nonverbal ways to communicate. So when I finally learned about the way the human cerebral cortex, that large part of the outside part of our brain that's largest in human beings, the way that is actually two different spheres, two different hemispheres, you might say, connected by some fibers, and that each side has very unique jobs that it does. Now, this can be so easily oversimplified, but in general, when we appreciate music, let's say, when we sit down and listen to a song that we really like, that's engaging largely the right side of our brain. If we're listening to a lecture from a college professor. All those words. Words are the left side of the brain. Visual, symbolic things are the right side of the brain. The more I studied the difference between right and left brain, and it's easy to find all this stuff on the internet.
Yes, exactly.
It began to make some sense to me why it was that pastors and musicians often had a hard time communicating. They really live in different mental worlds. Not always, you know, but as a general rule. Then as I did my Bible studies in college, I became aware of what a sensual experience worship was in the Old Testament, in the slaying of animals and the incense and the Levitical choirs that were singing in the temple, and how word-oriented our worship is today. And this disconnect, very different kind of worship experience, and the Bible tells us that God ordained the Old Testament to worship that way. There is chapter after chapter after chapter in the book of Leviticus and in Chronicles talking about how the temple should be built, what color you should dye the seal skins that are to be on the roof of the building, what to embroider on the priest robes, how they're supposed to be pomegranates and then bells between the pomegranate. You know, this is God's commands to how to build the temple. God is really right-brained. But he's also really left-brained, too. And so this is the balance issue. What I argue in the book is that if you want to minister to all the people in a worship experience, you can't just be all wordy, and you just can't be all symbolic. There needs to be a balance. And denominations often tend to go to one extreme or the other, leaving people out. And so I'm calling for a balance in a challenge to worship leaders, musicians, and pastors alike to create worship experiences that will engage everybody in their congregations, regardless of which part of their brain is more dominant.
You know, I just wondered, since you are a minister and you are a musical director, then did you have fights with yourself?
Oh, that's the world I live in.
Well, you said the music department was the war department, so, you know, I just wondered how this worked for you.
I'm schizophrenic, and so am I.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. Exactly.
Well, I'm sure there's some of that going on.
Yeah, but seriously, I mean, did you have a confrontation with the pastors?
What I noticed, I've been blessed. I've had mostly all good pastors to work with over the years, and have been involved, generally speaking, with choirs that really get along well. Mm-hmm. So this whole war department thing, I've been spared from a lot of that,
for which
I'm very grateful. But I see it going on all around me, no matter where I am. So that's certainly there. Where I have tension is what kind of work, when I have, for instance, at the seminary, the part of my job was to plan worship services for the seminary chapels. When I'm choosing music, do I choose contemporary? Do I choose traditional? How do I mix? No matter what I choose to do, I always feel guilty. And that's where I run into the problem, because I know I'm leaving some people out with no matter what I choose to do.
Sure.
And there's lots in my classical training that speaks against a lot of the praise and worship traditions. And it's taken me a long time to see that I really don't have any reason to be against that. It's been a lot of it, just knee-jerk emotional responses to a way of worshiping and a kind of music that isn't meaningful for me.
Right. So you've been able to put both sides together? Is that what you're telling me?
It's a challenge, and you keep running into those same issues, and I by no means am completely at peace with all of that. There's a term very common among people who look at worship issues in America today, and it's called the worship wars.
The worship wars.
There are books with that title, and it's a very, very common phrase. And it's by people who are saying worship had better be this way or better be that way or you're going to die. And musicians getting caught in the middle of all of that. Pastors getting caught in the middle of all that. To what degree do we change? To what degree do we honor the traditions of the past? It's difficult in a culture again,
yes,
is changing ever more rapidly. I don't think I'll ever be at peace about those things, ever.
Well. Well, you know, this has been a fascinating conversation here today. We certainly have covered a lot of issues. Do want to mention again that you are the choral director for the Festival Chorale, and that this you'll be getting rehearsals Tuesday, September 10th, 7 to 9. Is that right? Tuesday or is it Monday?
It is Monday night.
It is Monday. Okay.
No, excuse me. I'm sorry.
Tuesday.
It is Tuesday night.
Yeah,
First Pres Academy is Monday night.
Okay. That's right. And you're teaching that too. Yes.
Yeah, uh-huh.
So you're going to be very busy. But if you would like to be part of this, what do they have to do, Robert, to be part of the chorale?
Come and be prepared to sing.
Come and be prepared to sing.
I guess you should know whether you're a soprano, an alto, or a tenor, or a bass. That would help.
So come out and have a good time with them. Their next concert is going to be Tuesday, December 10th. It's titled Follow the Star. And, you know, there is nothing like good music to put your heart in the right place.
So true.
Absolutely. Robert Glick, thank you so much for coming out today and being part of the show.
I'm honored. Thank you, Ann, for having me.
Well, thank you. It's been a real joy to have some good conversation here this afternoon. And for those that have gotten riled up by it, good. I'm glad to hear that. We did our job today, Robert.
That's right.
All right. Well, you are listening to me, Ann Eller, and my very special guest today has been Robert Glick. You can, he's an organist and teaching pastor at First Pres Church, and he is the choral director at the Festival Chorale, and he still has his hand in over there at Erskine, too. You've been listening to WCRS right here in Greenwood. Bye-bye, everybody.